Excuse me, this is the operator. Just need to inform all participants today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect your line at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you very much, Laurie. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IOC with Cross Call on the 8th of February, 2012. On the call today, we have Christophe Lanaud, Stefan Hankins, Kiran Malantaroville, Konstantinos Komakis, Vanuya Jai, Greg Satan, Charles Gomes, James Bykoff, Thomas Rickert, J. Scott Evans, Steve Del Bianco, Amy Stafford, Osvaldo Navarro, and Deborah Hughes. From staff, we have Barry Cobb, Brian Peck, Glenda Saint-Géry, and myself, Natalie Perrin. I would like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you, and over to you.
Okay, well, if nobody objects, I'll go ahead and try and facilitate some discussion so that we hopefully make some progress on the call.
Any objections? Chuck, this is Amy.
Yeah, there you go. Hi.
Go ahead,
Chuck.
Amy.
Oh, so go ahead.
Hi. So I just want to clarify. Yeah, I am with staff. I think I know most of the folks on the line, but not everybody. And Brian just asked me to be on the call at the very beginning in case there were particular questions about the board's resolution respecting the IOC and Red Cross names. Of course, if there are any general questions, I'm certainly, if you want to send emails through Brian, I can respond to questions. And if there's not, I can certainly drop off. I don't want to interrupt your flow of the meeting, so I wanted to jump in at the beginning here.
Thanks, Amy. If anyone has a question for Amy about the board resolution or some other general questions, please raise your hand in the Adobe Connect room, or if you're not on Adobe Connect, just speak up. I'm not seeing any hands, and I'm not hearing anyone.
Very good.
Job easy today, Amy.
Excellent. Okay, well, thanks, Chuck, and thanks, Brian. And again,
Amy,
if you do have any additional questions, feel free to have Brian send them through, and we'll make sure they get answered.
Did someone say something?
No, I think that was Brian.
Yeah, I'm just thanking Amy for making the time available. And as Amy mentioned, just if you have any follow-up questions, just email through me and we'll get them to Amy.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye. Okay, so shall we just kind of walk through the options? And again, if people remember to identify yourself for the recording, and let's talk about the options to the extent that you have feedback. I noticed by some of the email exchange that you were in the same boat as me, is it took a while to start getting feedback from your stakeholder group or constituency. I finally started to get quite a bit the last couple of days, so I'll be able to share some from knowing that I'm not just speaking for myself but for other registries, at least in part, and hopefully some of you have some ideas. So shall we start with option one? And does anybody want to start the comments on option one? That was recommend no changes to the guidebook and reject the GAC proposal, et cetera. I won't read the whole thing.
Chuck, this is Steve. Pursuant to the request that Jeff gave us last week, at least in the business constituency, we looked at each question and then picked our preferred option. So we might not have a comment on every option, but we did have a preferred option.
Okay, that's good. And you want to just bring those up when we get to those, Steve?
Be happy to.
That'd be great. And I see Constantino has his hand up.
Yes, thank you, Chuck. I've circulated these questions to the non-commercial stakeholder group list. However, the answers that came only were from the non-commercial users constituency, and I would like to emphasize that for the record. The overwhelming majority of NCUC is leaning towards option number one. And that is for the main reason that many of the members were fearing the kind of precedent this special protection will provide, especially in light of the letter that was also sent to ICANN by other international governmental organizations. And generally speaking, what this process will do to the whole new GTLD process, and the fact that these protections, these requests, if you want, are coming quite late into the whole process. Also, there was some discussion about whether how the compatibility between this request and the GNSO, which is meant to create this policy. So at this stage, the majority of NCUC, because of fears, mainly of precedent, and also because they're not really convinced about the justifications, especially when it comes to the dot Olympic, to the Olympic mark, not so much for the International Red Cross as for the Olympic, they're not convinced that the Nairobi Treaty is applicable, and they're not convinced that special protections are required as coming out of the Nairobi Treaty, and they consider the existing rights protection mechanisms, existing and new, that are sufficient. So up until this stage, we will also send a report. NCUC is in favor of option one. Thanks.
Thanks, Konstantinos. Interestingly enough, the registries, and actually this decision was made before we even got this list of options, when the earlier motion was on the table in the council, and we were also concerned about undue precedent setting, but we felt, and I'm not just speaking for myself, it was a strong position on the part of the, all of the registries, that the GAC did a very good job in their request of essentially dealing with the concerns we had regarding precedents by identifying the uniqueness of the two strings with regard to international treaties and so forth. So we were also concerned about precedent, but came to the opposite conclusion, and so we oppose option one. Anyone else?
This is Tim Bykoff.
Yes.
Chuck, I just wanted to say on precedent that it's been made clear by the GAC that this would apply to no other organizations except these two, which I think are somewhat unique, as you said, in their international protection. The Nairobi Treaty is not being cited for protection of the word Olympic. It was only cited as an example of the international recognition given to the movement, not to the specific word. Both the Red Cross and the IOC rely on international sui generis protection, statutes in many, many countries that protect the word Olympic and other words that are used by the movement, and I think similarly the Red Cross has that type of protection also. So these are basically the unique features that are being relied on here and have been recognized by many countries and by the GAC.
Thank you.
This is J. Scott Evans.
Go ahead.
While the intellectual property constituency does not have a unified position, so I'm sort of speaking from my personal experience with regards to Constantinos and the NCUC's comments, the reality is that the majority of jurisdictions throughout the world do treat these terms different, whether we like it or not. There are many criminal statutes and extra special statutes beyond trademark law that protect these particular terms because they have been seen by the legislatures as somehow different from trademarks. So I think that to say that the precedent is already set, and it has been done by a great many governments throughout the world, and we are merely reacting to the reality of the world we live in. So I would say that, you know, there are other ways to achieve what the GAC has asked us to do, and yet I still think we can build in fail-safes so the concerns the NCUC may have about the term Olympic or some variant thereof would can be handled without just a flat-out rejection of the GAX request.
Thanks. Steve.
Thank you, Chuck. The business constituent actually supports option 5, but I wanted to speak to option 1 because the BC expressly objects to option 1, since we think it would be precisely the wrong time and wrong issue for the ICANN community to tell the GAC to take a hike, particularly given the context of the RAA amendment negotiations running into some snags at a point when most of the people on this call understand that the private sector role, nonprofits' role in internet governance, bodies like ICANN, is under significant threat by governments who don't want to let the private sector have such a big role to play. So all the merits of what I've heard so far, I would just ask those of you who are embracing option 1 to consider it in the context of who it is that made this request on behalf of the IOC and the Red Cross. GAC and the very same governments who, in many respects, hold ICANN's fate in their hands at the UN and other places. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Lon Ray.
Yes, all the options listed, except probably option 1, assume that the guidebook can be changed at this moment. But if it turns out that the guidebook cannot be changed at this moment, then it will be very difficult to consider all other options except option 1. So I think we need to clarify whether it is still possible at this time when the application has commenced, if the guidebook can be changed or not. If the guidebook cannot be changed, then we are stuck with option 1.
I didn't follow that totally. My apologies. Are you saying that we should eliminate option 1 or consider option 1?
I'm saying that we would not have any other option but to stick to option 1 if the guidebook cannot be changed at this moment. All the other options are assuming that you can change the guidebook. Is that correct? I need to be sure about that.
Well, I think the I think there can still be changes to the guidebook, and I should let staff speak to that. But my understanding is there still can be changes to the guidebook, although I think they would probably not be looking at any major changes. Now, we could argue, I guess, whether this is a major change or not. I personally would think it's probably not in the category of major. I do believe that there can still be some tweaks to the guidebook during the application period. Brian, do you want to speak to that?
Well, thanks, Chuck. I think, as we mentioned in the last call, I mean, as you said, there's a possibility that the guidebook could be changed, but it's, you know, obviously no guarantee, and it would have to be taken into consideration given the scope and level of implementation that would be necessary to do that. The other is that the options I think we're looking here is, again, in response to the board request to the GNSO to provide policy advice on how to proceed with this particular issue and how to protect these names if indeed, you know, it deems the GNSO Council does it, or GNSO does it, decide indeed to, you know, to provide some level of protection. So the viewing these options are not necessarily, you know, entailing or a required change to the guidebook. We view these more as within the scope of responding to the board request for policy advice from the GNSO.
Thank you. Does that help, Lon Ray?
Yes. In that case, we are now free to consider all the options listed.
Yes. Okay. Alan.
Yeah, I have a quick statement and then, but a question also. In terms of at large, there is no formal consensus. The general feeling among those who have been vocal is that, you know, I guess can be summarized as, why should we give these people special privileges? I think still Steve DeBianco's answer is relatively relevant in answer to that, among other things, plus the way they are treated internationally. My question is, option number one, when that says no changes to the guidebook, I presume that means but the restriction that the terms that these terms can't be used at the top level that the board put in the guidebook is still there for round one. For round one. Okay. So it doesn't mean they are not protected at the top level. It just means we are not recommending any more protection. But I'm not quite sure how that's rejecting the GAC proposal. I should have asked this question on the list, but I didn't really think of it until I read the words here and listened to the discussion.
So your question is what?
Well, the question is, what in the GAC proposal are we rejecting if we're keeping the restriction for using these names that was put in by the board and I believe is in the guidebook as it stands now?
Well, I don't have the GAC letter right in front of me, but
nor
did the
I.
GAC letter go further than what the board did?
At the top level? I don't think so.
But they did go. They talked about second level as well.
Well, in the letter, they did talk about other translations.
Right.
But the guidebook, the board's words in the guidebook is relatively vague. So I guess I'd like to make sure I understand what option one is. My personal belief is option one is not what we should be doing. But there is certainly not a consensus within ALAC and at large, and it may in fact be the opposite.
Okay.
But
thanks.
I would like a clarification. I wish Jeff was on the call. Thank you.
Yeah, well, Jeff will have to clarify what he wrote here, but I'm pretty sure that maybe he didn't choose the best words to say recommend no change to the guidebook and reject the GAC proposal. But the idea was I don't know if he also meant rejecting the board's motion, which probably
require a change.
I'm not sure we'd be successful.
I don't think we would, but regardless, I think that requires a change to the guidebook, so that's why I'm a bit confused.
Yeah, right. So I wouldn't get too hung up on Jeff's language, recommend no change to the guidebook and reject the GAC proposal. I think all of us probably understand the gist of what option one was. So. But do you want Brian to come back with a response on that, Alan?
I think we need to be sure what we're talking about when we say what option we're preferring.
Okay.
I could ask Konstantinos, when you said NCUC is selecting option one, does that mean that, in your mind, Red Cross will be protected or will not be protected at the top level in round one?
This is Konstantinos. I don't have the guidebook in front of me, but my understanding is that there is a small section mentioning the Red Cross and the Olympic, and I think that my understanding is that it stays the way it is. The guidebook does not change. I mean, that was my understanding, but this is something that I need to go back and ask the members.
Yeah, okay. So your understanding is option one is that we are not widening the protection given by the board, but we're not trying to remove it either.
My understanding is that in option number one, it stays the same, the guidebook stays the same, the same way it is right now.
And this is Brian Peck. If you look at the question how Jeff posed it, as you all point out correctly, is that in the current guidebook, the two names are listed in a section called strings ineligible for registration for the first round. I think the GAC, again, in reading Jeff's language, the GAC proposal would request or proposes to protect the Olympic and Red Cross terms in the section 2.212, to similar to names such as test and example.
Okay.
So that would be the change. I think that, according to Jeff, is what the GAC is proposing, moving it away from, again, these strings ineligible for registration to actually putting them on the same level as names such as test and example.
Which includes translations, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Extending those terms to multiple translations.
And
also making them to subject to string similarity review.
Yeah, my personal opinion is that the intent of the board was not just to protect those particular letters, but the meaning of it in line with international agreements, and I think that would include translations. But
now I'm going to get to Greg because Greg's had a for a while, but I just want to comment.
Thank you.
It wasn't my understanding that the GAC was actually requesting string similarity review. I thought that was something that came up in our discussions, but we can deal with that later.
Greg, let you
jump in now, please.
Yeah. Right. I just wanted to bring up that I did dig up the letter from the GAC to the GNSO and the underlying proposal. And more, I think, as a point of information, just briefly wanted to read what the proposal, the GAC actual proposal was, which was that ICANN should amend the new GTLD registry agreement to add a new schedule of second-level reserve names. The new schedule should reserve those terms most directly associated with the International Olympic Committee and the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Movement, terms that are protected in international legal instruments and, to a large extent, in legislation in countries throughout the world. These reserve names are provided in the attached Schedule A. This proposal is intended to complement the permanent protection of Olympic and Red Cross words to be implemented at the top level.
Thanks, Greg. Steve.
Thanks, Chuck. When we had an explanation earlier of what's in the current guidebook, my question was, do we know if when the GAC prepared their letter, the one we are dealing with here, were they in full understanding of what was already in the guidebook with respect to Red Cross? And do we know implicitly they said that is insufficient? Thanks.
Would you like Brian to take that back or have someone take that back to the GAC?
If no one on the call knows, I'd love to understand whether they explicitly felt it was inadequate or not. Thank you.
This is Greg again. If I could just
answer to that.
If I could just read what it says in the GAC proposal, to the extent that it speaks to that, the last bullet point in their proposal says the proposal is intended to complement the June 20th, 2011 board resolution, which created a top-level moratorium. Future work by the GAC and GNSO Council is necessary to ensure permanent protection at the top level. Permanent protection for the Olympic and Red Cross terms should mirror reservation of the words test and example under Guidebook Section 2.2.1.2, extending to multiple languages and receiving consideration during the string similarity review.
Thank you for that, and yet that reflects that the GAC was fully aware of the June board proposal, board resolution, but I was wondering whether they had explicitly looked at the guidebook changes that came out later than that, and whether they felt the guidebook itself was inadequate. That's all.
That's unclear, and the date of the letter from the GAC is 14 September 2011. So.
But we're talking about two different levels. They're talking about reserving names on the second level. Am I not correct in this proposal? It says that they've already blocked it on the top level.
For the first round.
Yeah, and so they're saying, should we add these additional protections? The very fact that they use additional the word additional means that they believe protection at the top level alone is not enough.
That was Jay Scott, by the way, for the script, transcript and so forth. Remember to identify yourself for the record. Thanks. Greg, did you still have your hand up?
Oh, no, my hand will come down.
Okay, thanks. And Steve, same with you.
Sorry, hand down.
Okay, Alan, you're up.
Yeah, thank you. No, in answer to that last question, I don't think this is talking about the second level. The question of string similarity and contains, you know, in contains in was discussed at a little bit of length at the second level, and it was clear that the GAC was not requesting that. So if they're talking about string similarity reviews, that only applies at the top level. So I think that section that was just read out is talking about top level, not second level. I mean, they are asking for some second level protection, but I don't think that particular section that was read out is referring to it. I think so it's clear that the GAC proposal was talking about string similarity. It wasn't something that was just brought up in our meetings, as you implied, Chuck.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Alan, for clarifying. Steve, do you want a question to be asked of the GAC?
Well, I don't want to risk sending them off in the wrong direction with a question. So my intention was to see if anyone on the call could match up the dates of the letter to the date of the guidebook. But as you know, the letter itself starts off talking about second level, as J. Scott indicated, but it concludes on a final bullet on making a point about the top level.
Right.
So I know that the letter addresses both, and I wanted to know whether that letter was fully cognizant of the actual guidebook change that was done pursuant to the board resolution. Let's not ask the GAC. I don't want to do that right now.
It's Alan speaking. Did that change go in at just the last version that went out, that came out in December, or did it go in earlier than that?
I'll look at a red line, see if I can figure that out.
Okay, we spent quite a bit of time on options.
Yeah, my impression.
All of us have a better understanding as we continue to get feedback from our constituencies. Are there any final questions or thoughts on that? Okay. Let's go to option two, which is to treat the term set forth in section 22123 as reserved names, et cetera. And I won't read the whole thing there. Who would like to be first in talking about option two? Nobody's jumping up.
Just a point of order. Since we don't have control of the screen, can someone make it a little bit larger since we're not only talking about one option at a time?
Sure. Hold on.
Or give us control, one or the other.
Thank you.
Do both. How's that?
That's perfect. Now I can fix my ailing eyes. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for bringing that up, Alan. So let me kick it off. Because these were initially my own thoughts, but others in the registry stakeholder group were comfortable of bringing these up. Because the reserve names working group, as part of the new GTLD PDP, didn't recommend these names as reserve names, it may be best that if they're to be treated as reserve names, using the definition of reserve names in the guidebook, that it would probably be better to have some sort of process to come to that conclusion. So they would be set aside in the first round as the board is directed, but in subsequent rounds, either a PDP or maybe some other process. There were some in the registries that thought maybe it wouldn't have to be a full blown PDP. I'm not advocating one way or the other, but that it would make sense to. And I think one of the advantages of reserve names is that they do go through string similarity review. And as I said on the previous call, I think that's a healthy thing because that's designed to avoid user confusion. Whether they're reserve names or not, I think that would be helpful. So that's just my start of thoughts on number two. Let's go to Greg.
This is Greg. I guess option two just seems a little odd. If either the IOC or the Red Cross were to apply for .Red Cross or .Olympics and telling them that they can't have that new GTLD. I don't know whether either organization is planning to apply, and nobody will until the day of the big reveal. But it seems to me that if either organization did want that top-level domain, telling them that they need to wait for the as yet unscheduled second round to do so doesn't seem like a good result.
Good point. Thank you. Anyone else on option two? Alan?
Yeah, thank you. I agree with that last comment, but what I was commenting on is point C in it is there is no appeal. I asked this question on the list, and no one picked up on it. My understanding is, according to the bylaws, the board review and the ombudsman are always available to question how anyone is treated by an ICANN process. So under what conditions are we saying, indeed, there is no review?
That's an interesting question. because considering there will undoubtedly be hundreds of applications, if the independent review or ombudsman or any of those processes were brought in and every time somebody didn't disagree with a decision, it could really bog down the process. But I confess, I don't know that I've ever heard that specific question asked the way you did. So it's a fascinating question.
I mean, I don't think the guidebook in the interest of efficiency can overrule bylaws.
Well, I don't have the language in front of me right now, but there's some pretty specific language in Module 6 of the guidebook in terms of the applicants agreeing to accept the decisions of the process.
Okay. All right. That may be the catch which gives it to us.
Okay?
Yeah. Thank you.
Chuck, right. Just to let you know, just really quickly, Jeff Newman just sent an email, said he'll be on in a couple minutes.
Good. I'll be glad to turn it over to Jeff. Greg, is your hand still up?
No, just stuck.
Okay, I understand. I've done it plenty of times. Well, let's go on to option 3 if there are no more comments on 2. This is the idea, and I think it's a term that Jeff came up with himself, the modified reserve names thing, which is a new term, and I won't read the explanation there. Does somebody want to talk about option 3? Anybody want to kick it off?
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Is this Jeff?
I have to apologize. Okay. I was this is being recorded. It's a great. I was at a stop sign, coming back from lunch, and while I was at the stop sign, a car decided to make a left-hand turn in front of me, so like it was coming perpendicular, and he decided to hit my car. As I'm just stopped, I'm just watching him turn into my car. He didn't make the left-hand turn wide enough. So, sorry about that. I had to stay and collect some information, and I'm here.
Jeff, this is Chuck. Let me tell you where we're at, and I was kind of volunteered to just start the discussion. And so what we've done, I don't think we have time to repeat it, but you can listen to it on the recording and so forth. We had, I thought, some very healthy discussion on option 1. And a little briefer discussion on option 2, and we just started option 3, and just generally discussing. I think, as you've seen on the list, a lot of us are still getting more feedback from our stakeholder groups and constituencies, but there were some good thoughts shared so far that will hopefully help us zero in on options. And I would certainly welcome turning it to you.
Let me, why don't I just have you do the next 2 minutes while I'm signing in. Someone needs to accept me on Adobe. But let me, and then I'll join in, like, right afterwards.
Okay, you just let me know when you're ready, and that will be fine. So option 3, I have a few comments that have been shared with the registries and have some support, but I'm welcome to let somebody else start it off. Okay, Konstantinos.
Thank you, Chuck. Very briefly, if my understanding is correct, under A, for example, and I'm speaking right now in my personal capacity, I think I've discussed it and I've said that I've repeated myself quite a lot in this group. Personally, I think that making these strings available only to the International Olympic Committee in particular will contradict many trademarks, for example, that exist in Greece, as well as many geographical indications. So in that sense, I really think that it would be highly unfair to assign the term Olympic and all its variations to the International Olympic Committee when there are also legitimate rights within Greece and outside. I am thinking of the Olympus trademark here, the cameras, that might want to apply for GTLDs. Thanks.
Thank you, Konstantinos. Anybody else before I jump in?
And then, Chuck, I can take over after you jump in.
Okay, good. Well, then I can jump in as just a registry stakeholder representative, so that will be good.
Great.
Okay, well, I'm not seeing anyone else or hearing anyone else, so, several of us in the registries, in fact, nobody objected to this approach. We were okay with this one, except that we think it would be good, and I think this goes along the lines of what Konstantinos was talking about and what we've talked about on previous calls. We're supportive of an exception process whereby an applicant having trademark rights, for example, Olympic Airlines or something like that, could be granted a string if there was a proof of non-objection from the applicable organization, the IOC or Red Cross or whatever, and or the GAC. So that's so far what we've come to in the registries, that this one might be okay if there was some sort of and we would be supportive, I think, of an exception process for other rights holders. It's all yours, Jeff.
Thanks. And maybe, Chuck, did you have any ideas, or the registries have any idea on how that exception process would work? And when we say an exception process, it would be after the fact or after string similarity is found?
Well, we didn't get that far. We didn't get into the details. Since we're talking about the top level right now, if there was an exception process like this used, there would need to be if it was a proof of non-objection from the IOC, for example, I would think that would need to be right up front in the application. But frankly, we didn't try to refine the details on that. This wasn't necessarily the strongest option, I don't think, that we had, but we're okay with this one with that exception.
Okay. Anyone else want to comment on this option?
Jeff, it's Jim Bykoff.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Sure.
I was just going to say, I think that from the standpoint of the committee, the International Olympic Committee, three or four, would either one would be acceptable. I think the letter of non-objection would be clearly something that would be okay with the committee, because certainly if there is somebody that has legitimate rights, they would agree to such a letter.
Okay, that's helpful. Konstantinos, what about that? I mean, you've talked about the rights of others. I mean, would that be something that's acceptable within your community?
I can't speak about on behalf of my community at this stage on option number three, but I would like to bring to the attention of this group that there are not only trademark rights associated with the term Olympic, there are also geographical indications. And I find it quite concerning that a government like Greece will have to go to the International Olympic Committee to ask permission to use a geographical indication that is located within its territory. But I will take it back to my group, and I will certainly come back to you on that, Jeff.
So when you say a government, you're talking about Greece itself applying for a trademark?
Yeah, well, not a trademark, but...
Yes,
for a geographical indication, for example.
So if Greece itself were the applicant for...
Well, like you have, you know, the application for Dot Berlin, you could have Dot Olympiad, which is a place in Greece. So the idea that this will have to go through the International Olympic Committee in this stage, personally, I find it a little bit concerning. Or problematic, better yet.
Could I reply to Konstantin? Jeff?
Yes, and then I'll go to Alan. Yes.
Jim Bykoff. Even under the laws of many countries, including Greece, the words are protected, and... they are within, you know, the statute that exists in Greece since 1998. So I'm not sure you know, if he's familiar with the statute, Constantine, if you are, maybe you could tell us, because it seems to be very clear that it is protected even in your own country.
Yes, well, but what is protected is not just the term. It's the term associated with the five circles. And here we're just talking about a name.
No, I'm sorry. I don't read it that way. It says the Olympic symbols, the terms, the motto, the badges, and trademarks are protected.
Yes. So where is the word that is protected specifically in that sentence?
The terms Olympiakos, Olympiad, the motto, Citius Altius Fortius, both in Greek and in any language, as well as the symbols and trademarks of the Olympic Committee are protected according to the provisions of Law 2239/1994. And in fact, it goes on to say in provision number 7 that the relevant provision prohibition also extends to the use of these terms as domain names on the Internet.
And then I do want to go to Alan. Constantinos, isn't what you're saying, wouldn't that fit within option? I know we haven't gotten there. But there is an option down in, I think it's 5B, which could be a non-objection from the Olympic Committee or the relevant government. But let me go to Alan and then Greg, and then if you want to come back in the queue, Constantinos, let me know.
Yeah, my comment was a question to Constantinos, so it's appropriate if he comes back. One of the things you said is you're objecting to it because of things like Olympus camera. Now, I don't see the term Olympus mentioned in the GAC document, so I'm and it's certainly not confusingly similar to Olympic, I don't believe. Maybe someone is more easily confused than I am. So I'm not quite sure if your argument is bringing in things that are not really indicated in this option. If you could explain.
Yes, this Constantinos, I think that this specific issue about the Olympus trademark, the camera, was discussed in the previous call, Alan, and that's why I brought it forward. And my understanding, and I might be wrong here, is that we are seeking to protect and their variations, and that can be classed as a variation. But as I said, I might be... mistaken about the variations issue.
Yeah, I didn't think option 3 was talking about variations, though, but maybe.
Well, it's not, so let me just jump in, and then I'll go to Greg. It's not that it covers variations, it's just that there will be a string similarity review, which will use the same criteria as the string similarity review for the other strings, which include reserve names, which would include existing TLDs and other applied for TLDs. So it's not saying that variations automatically have some sort of protection. It's just that if there is string similarity found using that criteria, then there would be no appeal, right? That it would be rejected. It would be rejected. So let me go to Greg.
Yes, this is Greg. I just wanted to... this is partially a point of information or clarification. I don't pretend to be an expert on Greek geography, but in doing a little quick research, the only place called Olympiada in Greece I found is a village of about 700 residents in Chalkidiki province, I think. So I just find that the idea that, you know, the Greek government would spend $500,000 to put up a first-level TLD for a town of 700 people, not particularly compelling as a reason to kind of, you know, assert the rights of the Greek government.
Yes, this is Jay Scott. I'd like to get in the queue, and I don't have access to Adobe.
Sure, Jay Scott. Anybody else after Jay Scott? Okay, Jay Scott.
Again, this isn't the position of the IPC because we haven't had a chance to go through all of these, although we've had some discussion. I can say that they would find 3 worrisome. And while I think Jim makes a very, very good point in the fact that the Greek government itself has said that these terms are protected, and they're protected beyond trademark law, as many governments have recognized. I think the biggest concern that... and I think this is Constantinos' concern as well, is there needs to be some sort of safety valve. And I don't think it's an adequate safety valve for a rights holder to have to get permission from the Olympic Committee to use its trademark. I think all they should have to do is demonstrate that they have legitimate rights to the term that are recognized, let's say, a trademark registration for my government, separate and apart from the Olympic International Olympic Committee, and that should be sufficient. They shouldn't have to ask permission if they can establish that they have prior rights that coexist.
So, Jay Scott, and that's why after the last call I created this kind of option six, which
I don't think it should be an appeal, but I think it should just be you demonstrate you have rights in the term. It coexists with it now in the real world. That should be enough.
Right, so the reason I had it as an appeal is because just more of a mechanics as opposed to maybe the word appeal.
Right, right.
It wouldn't become an issue until after string similarity is found.
Right, right, and I agree, and I like that. That seems to me, while people, even the people who chafe at this, and there are trademark owners, IP owners who chafe at this, I think that as long as there's a fail-safe that you can point to say you're not completely locked out, if you have legitimate rights, you're not completely locked out of the system, I think that that's a workable solution. It's not a perfect solution, but this is ICANN, and we threw it out perfect about 12 years ago.
Let the record reflect that. Chuck?
Yeah, just a question for Jay Scott. So, do I take that to mean that the IPC may not like the board resolution for the first round in that it appears that other rights holders would be locked out?
I'm saying that there has been some discussion. It has been very minimal, but I represent everyone, that why should there be special protection for anyone? But then my answer is the same answer I gave Konstantinos at the beginning, is because the reality is governments around the world give these two institutions broader protection than any other trademark owner in the world. And that's the reason it's different, is because that's just the way it is, whether we like it or not.
Oh, so you're saying you don't like it because it gives special privilege to some rights holders over others, but
I think there's that argument, and also that there's a fear they could lock people out, and I think that's the reason there has to be some sort of safety valve to ensure that that doesn't occur, and I'm not so sure making the organization that receives the protection as the gatekeeper is the best idea. Or that certainly can be one option, but it shouldn't be the only option. We certainly saw that in the cat example, Caterpillar was more than willing to give a letter of consent.
Yeah, and no, that's helpful, Jay Scott, thanks, because I think that helps us kind of zero in terms of where we're going with possible recommendations. Appreciate it.
And so, let me go to Thomas, and then I'll put myself in the queue. Thomas?
Thanks, Jeff. I think what frightens me is that we don't only have the identical names, but also translations thereof, which gives us a very huge number of terms that would be run against a similarity check. And that would be the similarity check as we see it defined in the guidebook. So I think what would be needed is a modified similarity check, allowing for a panel to look at the intended use of the TLD. You know, not only looking at the string and its potential similarity to existing strings or other strings that are applied for, but if there was a trademark, you know, a legitimate right in the jurisdiction somewhere around the world, and if the goods and services that this trademark has been granted for does not conflict in any way with what the Olympic Committee and the Red Cross are doing. And I think if we got these extra safeguards in there, then there would at least be a panel looking at that, and we wouldn't have anybody excluded from day one just by applying.
Yeah, and I think, and Thomas, I think it's a good point. I just think just because of the mechanics of the process, the way it's set up, there's going to be a string similarity review that's done as the very first thing, or one of the very first things. And once the string similarity review is done, it would only be after something is found to be similar, would they look at the other factors? And I'm almost seeing an option, and I hate to do this, but I'm almost seeing an option 7, which is really just option, which is just option 3. But if string similarity is found, then you basically look to see whether the applicant has established some sort of legitimate rights, and that could be, that could take into consideration a letter of non-objection, or just a general demonstration that you have rights. However, that would be done. It's almost an option 7, because I notice option 6 is really refers back to option 5 as opposed to option 3. It must sound confusing for someone who's not looking at the document in front of them. But, you know, in the risk of jumping ahead to try to come up with some sort of solution as opposed to going through each option separately, fundamentally, does anyone have an objection if we basically kind of had this option 7, which would look exactly like option 3, except, well, it's not even option 3, right? Now that I'm looking at it. It's basically the option where they would do a string similarity review, and if it's found to be similar, the applicant has to demonstrate some sort of legitimate rights. And it's not quite like any option.
It could include a letter of consent from one of the organizations.
Right. So it could
be sufficient.
Right. So it could either be the Olympic Committee itself, the Red Cross itself applying, or any other entity that believes they have legitimate rights, and of course there'd be some sort of determination made on that, whether they have legitimate rights or not. Chuck?
Yeah, Jeff, I think you're onto something. Whether we've nailed it yet, I don't know. But in all the conversation we've had so far, there it seems like there's some pretty good common agreement about the direction we're going. So I support the idea of trying to refine. It's fine if it's an option 7 and combine some of the things from above. That's kind of the way this was anyway. There was quite a bit of overlapping. So I'm supportive of the direction we're going, and I think it's a positive direction.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I tend to agree. It has the added benefit that it gets rid of the of the A part of option 3 implicitly. As long as the organizations have a right to it, then they can demonstrate that and bypass the implications of the string similarity. So it simplifies the process as well. So I like the way we're going.
Okay, and so basically the notes I have, it would be an option that would say, I guess it's kind of the notion of the modified reserve names, where you're going to do a string similarity review. In the event that there's string similarity, then the applicant is given some sort of, and I don't want to call it appeal for the reasons that Jay Scott mentioned.
An opportunity.
The applicant is given an opportunity to demonstrate it has legitimate rights to the string.
And that there will not be confusion. That's Alan speaking.
I don't think you could, I guess you could do that, Alan, but I just think it's legitimate rights, because if you have legitimate rights, with one of these two marks, you're coexisting in the world with them. These marks are omnipresent.
And it's hard to do
a very subjective thing. You should be able to say, I have rights. Now, that doesn't mean that the organization couldn't then bring a legal rights objection. If they didn't agree with that, they thought there was going to be confusion, they still have, the Red Cross and the IOC still have an out.
Yeah, you're right, they do. I was trying to cover the case of Olympic Airways.
I get it, but that should be left to the legal objection, because they should have to play in the same playing field with everybody. We're giving them this first step. It's extra, because they're special, but we don't want to go too far.
Okay, you're right. They still have the ejection process to handle the outliers.
You know.
And I see a comment from Stefan, or is it Stephanie? I apologize.
Yes. Hi. If I may, I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure what the procedure is to put the hand up. May I take the floor? Or?
Yes, absolutely. And there should be an icon in the box that's got all the people, in the top of the screen, which looks like it's a person raising their hand. That's actually how you, if you find that on your screen on Adobe,
near the top left.
Okay. Thank you very much. First of all, I do want to express the gratitude of the International Committee of the Red Cross, and I will speak on the behalf also of my colleague from the International Federation of Red Cross, Red Crescent Societies for the opportunity to attend this working group for the first time. We've been represented by our colleague from the American Red Cross, Deborah Hughes, until now very ably. But we're very, very happy to be able to chip in today. What has been discussed is, of course, extremely interesting to us. We had the opportunity, of course, to read your past exchanges. I would just like to speak to option three, which I think, from the perspective of the International Red Cross Red Crescent Movement, probably would be the most suitable from our perspective. I don't think there's a need here to remind of the international protective regime which applies to the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Pistol emblems. I think this has been presented and discussed in the past in this forum, so I won't go into that. Simply, of course, I do want to remind, of course, the specificity of the emblems of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, their actual origins, the fact that, of course, they lie at the heart of international humanitarian law. Their purpose is to serve as a protective emblem of the medical services of armed forces and those who provide medical care on the battlefield. So the protection and the international protective regime, which is enshrined in international law and international treaties which have been ratified by all the states, the Geneva Conventions, underscores this. The consequence of this, of course, is that the emblems don't actually belong to the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement. If one wants to speak in terms of belonging, they belong to the states, because they are the protective emblem of medical services of the state armed forces. And of course, that explains also and gives clarity to why the GAC has actually contributed on this file and taken up the question. I just wanted to remind that. As you know, of course, the protection of these emblems under international law is very strict. Those entitled to use it as a protective device or an indicative device are very limited. And the notion of legitimate rights, which we have discussed, is something which, you know, cannot be discussed abstractly. It has to be looked at in relation to the international legal regimes that apply to this protection, with a very limited number of organizations and persons who may carry the Red Cross Red Crescent emblem. Of course, it is the case that components of the International Red Cross Red Crescent movement, whether the international components or national societies of the Red Cross Red Crescent, are given the entitlement to make use of the emblems as an indicative device, but this is very much a unique case. It's a unique privilege that is given to use the emblem for the purpose of identification, and it doesn't the entitlement or the authority to give the right to display or to use the Red Cross Red Crescent name is not something, you know, that can go beyond the requirements of international law. And I think that that would exclude option four. As regards our point of view, as I said, I think option three would presumably be, you know, the most suitable. It would allow, indeed, components of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement to apply, although, you know, no decision has yet been taken within the movement on applying for those names, but reserving that entitlement would reflect also the entitlement that we have to use the name of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal for indicative purposes. Now to the similarity check question, I think what we would have liked to remind is that it's not just the emblems and the names that, of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal, which are protected under international law. It is also imitations of those names which are prohibited and that are crimes under international law and which are punishable also under the legislation of many governments, as apparent in an annex which was submitted by the GAC to their submission. So I think, although, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't have the details of the similarity check procedures as they will be implemented, but certainly, you know, that similarity check would potentially allow indeed for stopping the registration of names which are very similar. For example, if we think of the word Red Cross, which would be spelt with three S's, for example, then, you know, that should not pass the test of the similarity review. I would have commented, but I don't want to speak too long, but I could have commented on 5A and 5B, because indeed, as I understand, the only difference is that 5A and 5B would permit an applicant, or as the case may be, an unsuccessful applicant who would want to apply for the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal name, this person could apply for a waiver in the form of a letter of non-objection. And I think here on 5A, well, as I think I've indicated, the International Red Cross, Red Crescent movement doesn't really, you know, own the emblems, and the notion that it would be able to offer a waiver, I think, is difficult to reconcile with the strict legal regime. Whether the 5B, which would be the option, if our understanding is correct, to offer to the states the ability or the authority to offer the waiver in the form, here again, of a letter of a non-objection. I think also here, this raises a number of questions. One of the questions is, it says, from a relevant government, which would be the relevant government which would have the authority to do so, because, of course, you know, these are internationally protected emblems, and under international law, and all the states have acceded to these treaties and have a vested interest in their protection. Maybe I'll just leave it at that. But we wanted to chip in maybe some words from the Red Cross, Red Crescent perspective, if we may. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stefan, and thank you for those comments. And I'm glad you have joined the call. I think your perspective, as well as the perspective from Jim and the Olympic Committee, are very important to the work of our group. I didn't hear you talk about is kind of this new option that we're creating, which is sort of like option three, except we're basically saying that we're giving it, if they fail the string similarity review, we're giving the applicant an opportunity to demonstrate it has legitimate rights to the string, and that could be in the form of this letter of non-objection. And you know, you talked about the difficulties of getting a letter of non-objection with respect to Red Cross and those marks. What about an option like that?
I think, as I mentioned, the notion of legitimate rights is something that, you know, is difficult to define to begin with, and which in some degree, of, to my understanding, you know, it is difficult to reconcile with the strict international legal regime that I have referred to, and which protects the use of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal names. The entitlement to display or to use the names is extremely restricted, and the notion that someone could, outside of those specifically designated under international law, to display or to use the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal names, would come up and you know, be able to advocate for legitimate right is something that is difficult to imagine.
Yeah,
the range of users is extremely limited.
If there was a dispute, let's just take it out of the ICANN realm. If there was a dispute with someone that was using the Red Cross name, that would, what you're, I think what you're saying is that would be handled usually. The party that would enforce those rights would be the national chapter, and they would go to court to enforce their rights. Is that correct? So it would be like if I'm in the United States and I use a Red Cross mark in a manner that's not authorized, that would be enforced by the American Red Cross in the U.S. courts, correct?
In principle, it is the responsibility, and these are firm obligations undertaken by the states under the Geneva Conventions. It is the responsibility of the government to enforce this the international legal protective regime. There is, in practice, and within the mandate of the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement components, you know, they have mandates to support the states, if you will, to put it in that manner, in monitoring and prosecuting. But the primary responsibility is with the states, and that again comes back to what to the point that I was making, that these emblems do not belong to the movement; they are lent to the movement. They belong to the states because of their, you know, their primary function.
Right. Okay, let me go to Alan.
Yeah, thank you. I guess perhaps a question for Stefan, but I'll state what I was going to say first, and we'll decide where it goes at that point. I think Stefan was saying that for the Red Cross, it is hard to imagine that there are legitimate uses which would not be disallowed. And in that case, that makes your option 7 more palatable, I think. That, yes, it would have to go through this process, but it's hard to imagine that there are any legitimate uses, and that means not a lot of things would be caught by that filter. I mean, for better or worse, we've been asked to address not only the Red Cross, but the Olympics, and there certainly are a lot of imaginable uses of the term Olympics and Olympiad outside of the Olympics. Olympic Airlines is the classic one, but there's, you know, all sorts of others.
Yeah.
So I would think that Stefan's position of it's hard to imagine a reasonable exception just makes that option more palatable.
Yeah, if I may. So
sure.
Just
a second. Yeah, I'm finished. Thank you.
Yeah, first of all, I would like to invite Christophe Lannan, my colleague from the International Federation, if he wants to chip in. I invite him to compliment. I may have expressed myself improperly. I mean, as I said, the notion of legitimate rights is governed and strictly regulated. So there are two uses of the emblem that are strictly defined under international law. The protective use, medical services of armed forces, civilian medical units in times of conflict which are duly authorized by their authorities. And then there is the components of the movement who may use it as an indicative device. I'm not giving you the detail, but it kind of comes down to that. So I do continue to think that option three, which actually clarifies and does put the line which would be drawn and of course the string similarity review would have the role to enforce it. The line would be drawn in congruence with what international law and many domestic legislation foresee.
Okay, Christophe.
Okay, thanks. So I'm also from the Red Cross and would like to come back to two very important issues, I believe. The first one is the one that Konstantinos has mentioned earlier, which is that in terms of protection of the name Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal, it's not a trademark issue. And I think that Stefan went back also to that issue to show that it's something which exists on the basis of universal treaties which have nothing to do at all with trademarks. So we are not in a problem of commercial rights. The second aspect is that why do we need that protection right now? Let me explain you something. As soon as we have a disaster in the world, you very quickly have some websites which are established on the name of, let's say, Japanese Red Cross as it was 1 year ago. Suddenly after the earthquake, you have some people who are establishing some fake websites saying, let's give money to the Red Cross. And this is what we are really fighting. So this leads to a question, which is how to prevent that by having fraudulent uses of GTLDs that include Red Cross, Red Crescent, but also how can we avoid that someone create a GTLD which is, for instance, humanitarian, and then at second level adds redcross.humanitarian. And this is something on which we don't have the answer, but in any case it would be a breach of national law. Simply we would have to take care of it instead of having a possibility to prevent it. And that, for me, that's a key point.
Okay, thank you, Christoph. Alan?
Yeah, thank you. In relation to one of the points that Christoph just made of second-level domain names like Haitian Earthquake .red-redcross.org, we understand why you would like to see that such names aren't possible, but that's not one of the requests that we're looking at right now. The GAC has explicitly said they understand that would be a nice thing, but it's virtually impossible or very, very difficult to implement, and they haven't asked for that. So I just want to set expectations that what we're talking about right now is top-level domains. We will be talking about second-level domains later, but it's not. We have not been requested to include in that names, domain, second-level domain names, which include the protected strings. So I think we want to make sure that we don't have expectations which are completely out of line. Thank you.
Yeah, understood. Yeah, absolutely understood. Yeah.
I think one of the points, too, I just wanted to come back to Stefan's point. One of the points that I thought I heard was that even if you have in this option 7 the concept of demonstrating legitimate rights, it's not very easy to have a panel that could preside over that, because the determination of what is and what is not legitimate rights are left up to the individual nation states within their own territories to decide, you know, what uses are proper and what uses are not. And it's not really something where there's any kind of judicial type standard that it could be measured across. Is that one of the issues as well?
No, I'm sorry if what I said was not clear. What I mean is, in fact, the legal standards on, you know, the entitlement to use, display the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal emblems and names are finite. That is, that, you know, the authorities that may display the emblems in certain circumstances, and those organizations that may display the emblem as an indicative device, essentially it's the components of the movement. This is a finite list, and the domestic legislation of states, which the GAC, I think, provided a very extensive list, reflects and implements that legal regime. That is, that, you know, beyond those duly entitled under international law to display or to use the name, there is no entitlement, there is no contest possible as to legitimate rights, you see.
Okay. I think I understand, but it almost goes back to Alan's point. Is there an operator that can deal with that? There we go. It goes back to Alan's point then. If it's a very finite list of what could be a legitimate right, then is it really a harm to recommend this new option 7, which includes everything in option 3, except the ability for someone to demonstrate legitimate rights? And if there's not much that can be done to demonstrate legitimate rights, then it's pretty much no harm in giving them the ability to try.
Given that, it's Alan, given that there still will be an objection process allowed.
Correct. There will still be the objection process afterwards.
Well, I don't know, Christophe, do you want to comment additionally to what I said, or?
No, not so far, no.
Mm-hmm. Okay, does anyone, so it seems like we're sort of heading down a path where we at least have conceptual agreement, but I want to make sure to go through the list and make sure everyone's had kind of their thoughts heard. I think Steve Del Bianco from the business constituency had to drop off a little bit early, and so it'll be interesting to get the BC's view on this. And what I think I will do is I'll write up this option and then have everyone take this particular option back to see, you know, to look at the language, to look at wording, to look at the concepts and see if this is something we can conceptually get behind. And I apologize for my voice. It seems to be getting worse and worse as we get through this call. At some point, I might lose it completely. Chuck?
Yeah, just a quick question, Jeff. On the options 4 through 6 that we already had on the table, I assume, since we didn't discuss those today, that you would welcome comments on those on the list as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would certainly welcome those comments, but if it sounds like we can get to a consensus on this option 7, that may not be... I mean, it's still good to get comments on it, because it's good to have the record built up that has comments on all these options, yes.
Okay.
But I would still like, if we can get... It would be fantastic if we can get to
some sort of consensus or as close to consensus as possible on this option 7, and that would be fantastic. Okay, I want to jump then to the second question, second overall question, which is, okay, so let's assume we went with this option 7, or whichever option we go with. The question is, give a little bit of background, the Olympic Committee of the Red Cross submitted an initial list of translations as more of an illustrative, or an illustrative list of names, in not just the English language, but in other languages. And the ICANN staff incorporated that particular list into the guidebook, and that was approved by the board. The question was, should it include additional languages other than that list? And if yes, which ones? And so the three options we came up with were, option 1 is no, just those languages that are in the guidebook. Option 2 is accept the GAC proposal completely and say it's protected in multiple languages, all translations of the listed names in languages used on the Internet. And option 3 is some sort of subset of option 2. So it's extending the protections to other languages, but not every single language used on the Internet. And I guess I want to open up the floor. I have not looked at some of the newer emails that have come in since the call started, but I do notice, just looking back, that the business constituency is with option 2. And let's see if there are any others. Osvaldo has said option 2 as well. And any other thoughts on this question? Chuck, do you want to give the registry position?
Sure, Jeff. We haven't talked much about it, but based on the feedback I got so far, expanding, I don't think the registries are opposed to expanding the number of languages that the protections exist in, assuming it's feasible.
Right. I guess, again, and that's one of the thoughts that I had is, it's one thing to state the premise that it should be protected in every single language that's used on the Internet. It's quite another to actually come up with that list. And so it would be maybe I'll go to Alan, and then if I could actually ask if the representatives of the Red Cross and representatives of the Olympic Committee maybe want to address that question after Alan.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Again, this is not an at-large position, but a personal one, as pretty much everything is that I'm giving right now. I don't see how option 2 is feasible. Pretty much what you said, not only is it a long list, but it's a changing list as languages that come to exist on the Internet, and hopefully that will be something that will change over time. So I don't think it's practical to implement. I'm not sure anyone knows what all the languages are that are used on the Internet. There's plenty of languages that are written with Latin characters, and we don't know what the languages are. So I don't see how option 2 is implementable at all. Option 3, given some specific subset of languages which needs to be defined, is certainly viable. Thank you.
Jeff? Hello?
Who's speaking?
Jim Bykoff.
Jeff, still here?
I'm sorry. Yes, I was on mute talking to my phone. Yes, let me go to Christoph, and then I'll go to you, Jim. Christoph?
Okay, thanks. We agree on the question of the feasibility of seeing all languages. If you have some languages in very remote parts of the world which are spoken by probably a few hundred people, it makes little sense. Can we imagine that we would help in establishing that list in most used languages? It's probably something that we can work on to help the work of ICANN or VOS managing the system.
Yeah, I'm speaking for personally. I mean, I think if you could come up with, I mean, ultimately a list will have to be made so that the evaluators could do the string similarity review and enter that into the algorithm and then do the personal review. So that list will have to be made. To the extent that you
can do that and give us that full list, that would be greatly appreciated. Jim?
Yeah, I agree with what Christoph said. I think the intention here was to have the translations in all languages used on the Internet. But, of course, if there are languages that are used by very small groups of people, obviously it would be reasonable to make some exceptions. But we, too, have lists of languages that we could submit. Maybe we would work with the Red Cross to produce a list that we could recommend that both of us would be in favor of.
So how do others on the drafting team, how do you feel about it? I think that's a very helpful suggestion, and I don't know, Jim, if that's something you can get together in the next week or two, but that would be extremely helpful, I believe.
Well, maybe after this call we could talk offline with either Stefan or Christoph to see how to produce such a list, because we have other languages that we've already have in translation, although not all of them, but maybe we could agree on a list that could be jointly submitted to save time and effort. I had one question, Jeff, and that is, what with other names that are referred to as including translations that are already in the reserve list, what languages are those available in?
That is a great question, and thank you for the reminder, because that was something that we were hoping to hear back from Brian on. Brian, were you able to get that list from ICANN staff? I'm hearing silence. Hey, Brian, are you still on?
There, I'm sorry. I was just did the same mistake of talking myself on mute. I apologize for that. Unfortunately, no. I did submit the request for that question a few days ago, and I've yet to hear back from them. And I apologize, too, because we actually had Amy, before we came on, Jeff, we had Amy on the phone, but failed to request that. So I'll, after our call here, I'll try to go down there and see if I can nudge an answer out of them for that.
Great. And actually, if you could coordinate then with Jim and Christoph, or at least send that list to the group, so that might help them as well.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? So it sounds like we like the spirit of option two, but we realize just from practicalities that it's going to have to be some version of option three. And Jim, on behalf of the Olympic Committee, and Christoph and Stefan will work together to try to come up with the list of languages that they would recommend.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Christoph has actually posted to the list. I think those languages are all may already be included, the ones that you have listed, Christoph, in the guidebook. But why don't you all work, if you can, work with Jim to come up with the full set of languages, and then that'll give us at least something to work with. Does that sound like you can do that?
Yeah, sure.
Great. Okay, then let's go to option three, and I'm hoping this might be the easier of ones at this point, since really we're in the middle of the first round, and we need to settle the issue with the first round. But this was in the GAC proposal, so we do need to address it, which is, should the protections in questions 1 and 2 apply to subsequent GTLD rounds? And, of course, option 1 would be, yes, it should apply always. Option 2 is, no, it should only apply to the current round, and we don't even want to talk about the future rounds. And option 3 is, it should apply in this current round, no decision on the subsequent rounds, but we should evaluate the results of this initial round, document lessons learned, and then decide on recommendations on subsequent rounds based on the results of the evaluation. So with that one, let me turn it over to Alan, and then I'll ask Chuck again after Alan.
Yeah, again, I'm having revelations looking at this document that I haven't had when I looked at it offline. Option 4 is one I like. That is, it applies to further rounds with the option of reviewing based on the experience. That last caveat, however, may be implicit on everything associated with the GTLD process, and maybe we don't even need to say that.
I mean, option three is really the first sentence. It should apply in this current round, but no decisions made on subsequent rounds.
Right.
The extra sentence in there, I could take out. That was just
But I'm saying we should suggest that whatever we're putting in place is permanent, with the obvious option, which I think applies to virtually everything in the process, that after the experience of the first round, it gets reviewed. So in other words, option one, I think, implies what I was saying is option four, because I think everything is on the table again based on experience.
Right. I think that's right, Alan. I think your option four is really implicit in option one.
Okay. Then I'll back out. Bye-bye.
Okay. Chuck?
Sure. On option one, it really depends on the lessons learned from the first round and whether or not a PDP is needed. So it's hard to say yes on that right now. Option two seems like a good place to start and then allow evaluation of that round and any PDP if needed. And then on option three, that seems good with the inclusion of any PDP if it's needed.
Okay. Just to go through the email, Steve DelBianco on behalf of the PC, they say they selected option three, which is basically the policy would apply in this round with no decision on subsequent rounds. Osvaldo has said option one, which is it applies to this and all future rounds. And let's see if there's any others. That would be it that submitted it on email. So, Konstantinos, please.
Thanks, Jeff. I think I'm speaking on behalf of NCUC, but in any case, I'm speaking on my personal capacity, and I think we should go for option two. But as everybody else said in this call, we should, after a year, we should sit down and evaluate whether this is the right option. And generally speaking, I would like to say that whatever we decide, we should not consider our approaches as if it's set on stone. This is a brand new process. We learn, we learn as we proceed. And generally speaking, there is a tendency within the ICANN circles to go back and revisit those decisions. The same has happened for the rights protection mechanisms that we said we're going to go back and revisit them. So, generally speaking, this should be presuppose that any recommendations that this group makes, we should go back and revisit them to see whether actually this group reached the right solutions. Thanks.
Thank you, Konstantinos. Does anybody, it sounds like people are in agreement that it's really something that we need to review. I'm not sure it's helpful to take a position yes or no, that it should definitely apply to future rounds or it shouldn't apply to future rounds, but certainly say that we want to go forward with it in this round and then, A, figure out how to review what happened in this first round, and to Chuck's point, figure out whether we need a formal PDP or something like that to have it apply to future rounds, so we kind of need some questions on the process. But also in any case, do a review to see if there's any lessons learned. Alan?
Thank you, Jeff. I think that's an extremely reasonable way to go forward and extremely unpragmatic. The reality is, yes, we want to go back and review things, but look at the UDRP. We haven't yet. We don't know when we will. There's only a finite number of things we can review. And I think, given the amount of effort we're putting into this process, we should leave a regime that can live in the second round. And if we say it should only be the first round and then reverts to zero, it's just going to trigger this process again. And I'm not a masochist. I think we should leave a regime which is reasonable, that we can survive, and not mandate that we're going to have to do this process a second time, one way or another. We're just not going to review everything in detail, and making that an absolute requirement is simply increasing the amount of work the GNSO and the community is going to have to do. So I think the option you're suggesting is reasonable. I don't think it's rational, however.
Now let me and looks like Greg and Christopher are in the queue, so I'm interested to hear their thoughts on what you just said. So Greg.
Hi, this is Greg. I guess I would just say that, you know, given what Constantino says, that it is in the nature of the organization to go back and revisit things from time to time as they need to be revisited, that whether we say, even if we were to say that it exists in all future rounds, it certainly would be open to review. I think requiring a review before the next round would be burdensome. If a review seems self-evident after the round, it'll occur. And if it does not rise to the level of the things that must be reviewed before the next round, it won't occur. So I think it's better to say that it's something that should exist now and in future rounds. And just like every other aspect of what ICANN does, it may eventually get reviewed. Certainly nothing that we say would prevent it from getting reviewed. We can't grave this in stone.
Okay, so it sounds like you and Alan are in agreement, and I think, Chuck, if we added some language to say it's our recommendation that this apply to future rounds, subject to any procedural requirements for a formal policy development process, would that satisfy? What do you think of that?
I think it would, Jeff. In my assessment, I don't think we're necessarily advocating a full-blown formal review, but there are going to be some lessons learned in the first round, and it would be good to incorporate those.
Okay. So,
sorry, Jeff, this is Constantinos. And we can make mistakes. So are we suggesting that if these mistakes are being obvious after the first round, we should not revisit it just because it's burdensome? I mean, here we're creating and we're establishing brand new principles. I've heard people referring to international law. We are trying to apply international law. Are we really saying that if we're mistaken just because it's burdensome, we should not revisit it? I think that's a little bit problematic.
So taking that comment and taking Greg's comment about if you require a review, that may be burdensome. We could recommend that a review be done without saying it's an absolute requirement. I think that is something, frankly, we should, because Constantinos is right. We're new at this. We're making a recommendation on this round, and we could be completely wrong, or we could be completely right. You never know. But you do need to have some lessons learned, and so we can make the recommendation, but not a requirement. So it sounds like we're saying option one, but we recommend a review of this this program after the first round, prior to the start of a second round, but it's a recommendation, it's not a requirement. Let me go to Christophe.
Yeah, I was almost on the same line of saying yes, it should apply in all future rounds, unless we realize suddenly that something is not working, and then we need to reopen the discussion. But to have a burden of saying we need to review it for the first round, actually, yes, seems a bit heavy, and at least from the Red Cross side, yeah.
Jeff, it's Jim Bykoff.
Yes, please.
I agree with Greg's suggestion, and I think Christoph seconded that. But I think that it should be option one, but subject to any recommendations for review that occur after the first round.
Okay. How about everybody else? Anybody else have a different thought? Okay. Costinos, is your hand still up
from before? Or is this new? Oh, yeah, okay, there we go. Okay, well, it sounds like we got through these three questions. We're going to do a write-up based on what we talked about today, clarify option 7, and ask people to really focus on that one, but also give us comments to the other options just so we have a complete record. Question two, Jim and Christoph and, Brian will ask ICANN staff and hopefully get an answer in the next couple days as to which languages the other reserve names are going to be, strength similarity checks will be done in. And Jim will work with Christoph or Stefan to try to come up with that list of languages. Sounds like question three, we're all the same position here that, yes, we're creating this rule for this round and future rounds, but we recommend that a review be done to look at the implementation of this program and see whether there's lessons learned to apply. It sounds like that's where we are on the three questions. I do want to talk about we are still trying to get a meeting together between members of the GAC and this group and the GMSO Council. Just as a reminder, this will be it's not an official GAC meeting. It's not an official GNSO meeting. Members of the GAC will be invited to attend if they have an interest in the subject. Anything they say during that call shouldn't be taken to mean that it's the position of the GAC. They're really just there to listen, to get a status update, and to help advance our discussions in Costa Rica. They wanted me very strongly to point that out, that this is not a official GAC group or there will be no decisions taken at this meeting, but I do think it will be very helpful to get in front of them. The goal is to try to get that the week of the, in actually 2 weeks, the week of the 20th. I don't have a definitive date on that, and I don't know if anyone from ICANN has heard anything. Brian, have you heard anything on that?
I have not.
Okay. So our goal is to definitely get it in before Costa Rica, hopefully with enough time that we'll give the GAC some time to talk amongst themselves on our progress. We do plan on having a call 2 weeks from today at our let's do it at this same time, the same hour and a half time slot. So that's, I don't know the UTC time. But if someone could help me and plan that and send that meeting invite out for the same exact time as this call, I will try not to get into an accident on the way back from lunch. I will hope that's a one-time event, especially because I was just really literally sitting there at a stop sign. And I now have to call my wife and tell her about this. So wish me luck. I think that's it, other than my voice going.
Jeff, it's Alan. On an administrative part of thing, I wasn't at the last meeting, and I hadn't realized this was a long meeting. I'm not sure if it was scheduled for 2 hours or 1.5. You just said 1.5, but we run for 2. Could I ask in meeting invitations say how long the meeting is if it's not the standard hour? Luckily, I wasn't otherwise committed, but I wasn't aware at all. So.
Yeah, I probably misspoke. I was looking at another meeting invite that was an hour and a half. We'll start it at the exact same time that we started this one, which was someone help me out on the UTC.
It's 1800 UTC.
Thank you very much. Yes, we'll start that at the exact same time in 2 weeks.
Can I just chip in? Can you just outline, possibly this is Stefan Henk and Vice Chancellor, could you outline for us maybe just the next steps and how this, the outcomes of this group will be brought to Costa Rica. Could you tell us very briefly?
Sure. So the goal is to present, we were formed to provide advice to the GNSO Council. The GNSO Council formed us because they needed some people to look into this issue, and so we formed this group to do that. So our task is to provide the GNSO with a position paper or report. I'm not sure what we haven't really given an official name to what we're going to produce. Present that to the GNSO, who in turn will most likely, because there's been some really good participation from the GNSO, the hope is that the GNSO will then adopt the position and then discuss that with the GAC in detail in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, the overall overarching goal is to meet with the GAC to hopefully come up with some sort of consensus position between the GNSO and the GAC to present to the ICANN board in time to adopt, at least at the top level, for before the application window closes. And the second level, you know, we still have to work on that, but the timing of that, we have a little bit more time, not too much more time, but a little bit more time to talk about protections at the second level.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
Jeff, it's Alan. Is that what you just described possible? Given that the GNSO only meets formally on Wednesday, and we generally only will pass a motion at that GNSO meeting that has been submitted at least a week beforehand, I'm not sure how we can have discussions early in the week that result in us doing something and then go to the board.
I think it'll be done at the Costa Rica meeting.
Okay.
I understand, and I know what you're thinking. You don't have to say it. There's not much time left in the application period window, but, you know, it's work we were asked to do.
Then we better have a blanket motion presented and get a waiver that we can put the right words in at the last moment.
I think that's right, or at least, yes, I think that's right. So there's some procedural hurdles we will need to jump through, and I will talk to Stefan Van Gelder and Wolf and the GNSO Council leadership to try to figure out how we think we can do that.
And the board will then have to waive getting a public comment period on it.
Details.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Okay, I want to thank everyone, and sorry again for being late. I won't let that happen again.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you very much,
thank you.
Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Goodbye.
Bye.
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 Thank you. And I'll stop doing